Hi, this is Alan Townsend, Senior Program Officer for World Wildlife Fund, and you're listening to the Water Values Podcast.
The Water Values Podcast is sponsored by the following market-leading companies and organizations: by Intera, Innovation and Stewardship for a Sustainable Tomorrow; by Xylem, Let's Solve Water; by the American Water Works Association, dedicated to the world's most important resource; by Black & Veatch, Building a World of Difference; by 120 Water, new rules need new tools; by Advanced Drainage Systems, our reason is water; by 1898 & Co., possibilities powered by experience; and by Woodard & Curran, high-quality consulting engineering, science, and operations services. This is Session 265.
Welcome to the Water Values Podcast. This is the podcast dedicated to water utilities, resources, treatment, reuse, and all things water. Now here's your host, Dave McGibson.
Hello and welcome to another session of the Water Values Podcast. As my daughter Sarah said, my name is Dave McGibson, and thank you for joining me. And thank you for your support over the last 10 plus years. We have a terrific show for you today. Patrick Williamson, a principal hydrogeochemist. Yes, you heard that right. A principal hydrogeochemist. I had no idea there was such a thing. With Intera, provides a great discussion on the various roles of water in mining. And Reese Tisdale is here with the Bluefield on Tap segment, telling us about his time at Science Capital's Rethinking Water Conference during New York's Climate Week. And he also shares some insights on his discussion with Stanford's Buzz Thompson on the role of private capital in the water sector. Well, as you know, we always say thank you to our fantastic sponsors at the top of every show, and we have some great sponsors in 2024. Our sponsorship lineup includes Intera, Xylem, the American Water Works Association, Black & Veatch, 120 Water, Advanced Drainage Systems, 1898 & Co., and Woodard & Curran. And that, as you well know, is a terrific collection of impactful companies that have affirmatively decided to support water industry thought leadership and education. Thank you all, and I'd like for you, the listener, to please do me a favor. If you work for or with any of those sponsors, please thank your boss or thank your contact at the sponsor firm and let them know that you appreciate their leadership in the industry through that sponsorship. That simple little note of thanks goes a long way. And as long as you're letting the sponsors know you appreciate their support of water industry education and thought leadership, hey, why not leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whatever other podcast directory you're accessing the podcast on? It'd be greatly appreciated. Helps others find out about the podcast. And of course, please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Well, before we get on to this fantastic interview with Patrick Williamson, we've got a Bluefield on Tap segment with Bluefield Research's Reese Tisdale. So take it away, guys. Well, Reese, welcome back for another Bluefield on Tap. This is our first episode of the fall. So how are things going?
So my birthday was the other day.
Happy birthday.
There you go. So first day of fall, I'm reminded every year. Things are actually they're great. I just got back from New York last night. I was at the, I guess it's part of New York's Climate Week or UN Climate Week, but also more importantly, the Science Waters and Columbia University's Rethinking Water event.
Yeah. So how's that?
Pretty good. It seems to be getting a little bit bigger, a little bit, it's not in a bad way that I say this, a little bit better every year. So had a lot of good meetings. Actually, the people that are attending now, you're getting more corporates. So we're seeing some of the big tech companies there. There were some oil and gas people that I was meeting with as well. So I thought it was good. It was well attended. It's just a one-day event, and there were several breakout sessions of which I was I led one discussion. So that's one of the reasons I was there.
Oh, nice. So any interesting characters?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if I can say characters. I've met a lot of interesting people.
There we go. Okay.
I will say this. So I'll just sort of cut to the chase. One of the things that I did do is I led a discussion with this professor from Stanford. So, I mean, he's a lawyer, so you speak his language. He was actually, I think he was a clerk of Supreme Court Justice Rehnquist at one time, but he's been active in the water sector for over 30 years. And he's just put out a book called Liquid Asset. And it's about how business and government can partner to solve freshwater crisis. So I led a discussion with him in a room full of people to answer questions about it. And so be happy to give you a quick book report.
Yeah, let's hear it.
So what I do like about the book is that I'll speak for myself. It speaks my language, right? It's not just about the problems of, you know, drought and crisis, but it really talks about what is the role of private participation in water, which I think, quite honestly, a lot of people steer away from in some respects. They get nervous about it, which I think Buzz Thompson kind of points out, says there are inherent risks to having corporates come in and grab everything and run. I think that is a concern, but I think he's fairly, you know, transparent about his thinking. And I think, you know, what he really talks about is what are the role of private or companies, so investor-owned utilities, for example, what's their role in the water sector? We talk a bit about regionalization, or he does in the book. He talks about water markets, the ups and downs of, you know, what's happening in California versus Australia versus Chile. And then he also just talks about other aspects of the water sector. You know, what is the opportunity for technology innovation? Is it needed? Are there specific inhibitors? So I thought it's a good, well-rounded book talking about the role of private participation in water, which I like.
All right. So let's take it from a macro view and then pan in. Can you kind of thumbnail his general ideas on private capital's role in the water sector?
Yeah, I mean, we did, you know, he talks a bit about public-private partnerships, which, as we both know, come with all sorts of problems. And really, they've not, I think, at the scale that people are looking for, have not succeeded. There is mistrust in the sector. I think a key ingredient to the challenge are water rates. Quite honestly, no one wants higher water rates. But now, even really since Biden administration came in, there's also a greater focus now on things like disadvantaged communities, rightfully so. But so someone's got to pay for all of these, and the challenges and problems begin to mount. I think, as he said, you know, there's $6 trillion of private capital sitting on the sidelines. So the question is, you know, what's their entry? Who do they partner with? And I think, you know, when it comes to the utility space, you and I both know a lot of these systems are really small, and the ones that are the greatest risk are really small. And so it's hard going door to door. And I think, obviously, Science Water or Science Capital, obviously, invited him to speak at this event because that speaks their language. They're an investor or owner of Central States.
Was there any discussion about, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. Ultimately, the consumer pays the rates. And when government controls rates, they artificially keep rates low typically. Was there any discussion about changing the traditional view on how rates are set?
He doesn't, you know, it's the challenge is, it, as you know, it's state by state, right? So every state's got a different formula, different math, different population. He talks about policy proposals and the role, you know, one challenge is, you know, if you compare it to like the energy sector, for instance, you at least have a Department of Energy, at least there's some oversight, broadly speaking, into what's happening. In the water sector, there is none of that. And it's subject to political whim. So he doesn't specifically have a tool or a silver bullet to solve that problem, which is, I think, one of the challenges.
Yeah. Well, because, you know, Philadelphia tried to implement an income-based approach to rates, kind of threading the needle between water's role as a commodity and water's role as a vital resource that people absolutely need. And so they kind of hybrided it through the income-based rate approach. typically water is treated like a commodity in rate making, and that's what causes the affordability problems for the people that need water in order to live but can't afford it. And so I'm just...
Yeah, and I think Philadelphia is a good example. I mean, they're held up as sort of a model or a potential model to follow, and I think it's come with mixed results at the end of the day. And I think it was early this summer, speaking to someone from Philadelphia Water, and their point was just baseline, we need to raise rates just to maintain. We need to raise at least 6% a year. That doesn't include anything else like PFAS or any other aging, unforeseen infrastructure-related failures and operational failures. So I think, so he didn't really get in that. And, you know, it's, I think the kind of the proof is in the pudding somewhat that beyond Philadelphia, we're not seeing much more of that. And so I think that's, you know, there's always, it's been subsidized through third-party organizations in many cases, but something that's more wide-sweeping or systematic, not so much.
Well, Reese, we have we could talk for hours on this, and I think we ought to reserve some of the discussion for a little later because we've already hit 8 minutes. So let's do a wrap on this now. And I thank you for introducing Buzz Thompson as the author of Liquid Asset and the panelist at the Rethinking Water Conference out there in New York. So thanks for your time, Reese, and we really appreciate your insights.
Absolutely. Always happy to jump on, and happy fall, happy pumpkin lattes or whatever.
Spicy pumpkin. It's always spicy pumpkin latte song. At least that's what the marquee said the other day.
All right. Well, have a good one then.
See you, Reese. Bye. As always, great information from Bluefield Research and Reese Tisdale. Now it's time for the main event, our interview with Patrick Williams of Intera. So let's get that water flowing. Well, Patrick, welcome to the Water Values Podcast. Great to have you on. How are you today?
I am well. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to our conversation. But before we get into that, could you provide a little background on who you are and how you came to the water sector?
I started out as a geologist. I grew up as an oil brat in Colombia, Venezuela, Holland, and Belgium, and parts of the United States. And so I got exposed to geology early on because I was surrounded by petroleum engineers growing up in Caracas, Venezuela. And then, really got into rocks. That was your standard rock climbing, outdoorsy liberal arts major, and got a geology degree. And then I found out after, I was working as a geophysicist, and one day I was cleaning out my, briefcase, and I discovered that I had a folder full of magazine and newspaper clippings that I had been collecting about acid mine drainage and superfunds and environmental contamination. And I realized, you know, this is what I'm really interested in. So I went back to University of Colorado Boulder and got a master's in environmental geochemistry. Started out working in superfund sites, did a lot of superfund sites, landfills, organic contaminants, site evaluations and closures. And then about early 2000s, I started to do more and more mine work, and then I made the transition in 2005 to strictly mine work, and that's all I've been doing. I've only been an environmental or a mining geochemist for the last 20 years. I had the opportunity to be the practice leader for Schlumberger Water Services and SRK in Mexico for 6.5 years. And most of my work is in Latin America.
Interesting. I had no idea there was an environmental geochemistry degree out there. So I've already.
It's not per se. It's a geology degree with an emphasis on low temperature geochemistry and ore deposits. My advisor made me take organic chemistry, which everybody said, "Oh, watch out, that's the hard course." And it was actually really fun. I enjoyed it very much.
All right, so. So you've been in the mining industry for about 20 years. First off, could you kind of just give us a foundation for what we're going to talk about today in terms of why mining is important? You know, why is it needed for society and our modern life?
Well, you know, the standard bumper sticker is if it can't be grown, it has to be mined. You know, pretty much everything that is not grown in a field or picked from a tree in our society is mined. Gypsum board for walls, concrete, asphalt. You know, I'm lumping petroleum products into mine as well. It's an extractive industry. But, you know, everything we have that improves our quality of life is mined. I mean, a cell phone's got 60, 65 elements in it. You know, you could not do what we do with a cell phone every day without the full range of elements that are mined in various different types of mining operations.
Yeah. You know, whenever I've throughout my life thought of mining, I've always thought of like gold mining or coal mining or something like that. But it's really a much broader industry than the narrow focus that I've kind of had my whole life on.
Yeah. Yeah. It includes steel, gravel, sand. You know, there's a sort of a subsection of mining, which is proppant. Proppant is the word for a quartz sand that has very good strength characteristics that is used to prop open fractures created by fracking, which is what's creating the whole new gas industry.
Right. And so I've always heard mining is water intensive, but I don't know why. So why is mining so water intensive?
A couple of different things. One is, if you were talking about hydrometallurgy, which is processing the ore with flotation, it requires large amounts of water because the actual product, be it copper, gold, silver, is a very small percentage of the actual mass of the rock. And so the rest of that material, the tailings, goes out to a tailings storage facility or a paste facility with a very high water content. And traditionally, a lot of that water was lost, either due to evaporation from the tailings ponds or it's entrapped in the pore space of the tailings. And so it was, you know, sort of rule of thumb was that for every metric ton of ore that you were processing, you were losing half to a full cubic meter of water. So the scale of mining, it just requires large volumes of water. And then the other aspect is dewatering. If you have a pit or an underground mine and it sits below the water table, you have to manage your groundwater to keep the water from flowing into the mine. For pit mines, there's also a factor of the slope stability is controlled by the pore pressure. And so you have to keep the water surface, the groundwater surface, back from the pit walls to maintain a stable pit wall. And so that isn't, you know, you're extracting that water. And even if you don't use it in processing, you've removed it from one volume, the ground, and you're putting it somewhere else. You're either, you know, in some cases like Round Mountain, Nevada, they move it over to the valley and try and re-infiltrate it into the valley alluvium. Sometimes that's just not practical. You know, sometimes you have to discharge it. So you're changing the water balance from groundwater to surface water. And that affects users and ecosystems.
Right. And I assume there's got to be some treatment before you can't just pump it straight from the mine to the stream, or is that, am I?
Well, that's a very good question because there are two types of water in mining. You have contact water. Contact water would be anything that is in contact with the tailings or the pit walls or stockpiles. And that can become contaminated with soluble metals or oil and grease from the roads. So that's contact water, and that has to be treated or should be treated. And then you have non-contact water. So when you're pumping, when you put a ring of wells around a pit, and you pump that out to depress the groundwater surface so that the pit stays dry, that's non-contact water. And that does not need to be treated because it has not come into contact with potential contaminants associated with the mining operation.
We've identified these broad spectrum of things that are mined. and we've established the water intensity of the process. Is one, are different types of extraction more water intensive than other types of extraction, or maybe extraction is not the right word. Maybe are different minerals or things that are mined more water intensive than others?
It's hard to make that kind of generalization. It really depends on where the mine is, and the commodity. I mean, lithium actually has an impact on groundwater because you're extracting the brine, but by pulling water out of the salars, you create flow into the salars. And that is, while it's not a contact, all of a sudden you're changing the hydric balance and you're making fresh water flow into the salar. It really is a function of climate, commodity, and location. If you've got a great big pit in a very wet place like Indonesia, you can have a lot of contact water. If you have a mine where there's a lot of groundwater flowing in and you're managing it within the mine as opposed to trying to intercept it with wells outside the mine, you're going to have a lot of contact water. I mean, it's not a clear white, black and white answer on that. It really depends on the circumstances.
So I know you said you do a lot of work in Latin America. Do you see different governance structures based on where the mine is located and kind of what do you see as, I'm just kind of curious here in terms of best practices.
That's a multi-part answer. Mexico has just recently implemented a focus. They're still writing the details, but in July last year, they started to say that we needed to focus more on water for human consumption rather than water for mining. The problem with a lot of mine operations in Mexico is that the upper two-thirds, the northern two-thirds of the country is very dry, and that's where all the mines are. And a lot of these mines are pumping water. They're competing for water with municipalities and agricultural interests. And so, you can't get in some places additional water permits. They've established that there is no more capacity in those basins for any other users. So there's now competition. So the only way you can get water for your mine is either to buy an agricultural water right and transfer it to your mine, or in some cases, this is an idea I'm particularly fond of, you go reach out to a municipality and you say, we'll take your treated sewage water, or we'll take your raw sewage and we'll treat it. And there's benefits to the municipality as well to the mine. And then we'll use that water for our processing. There's a mine down in Oaxaca called for Minera Cuscatlan that does that. They take the water from Ocotlán de Morelos, and they invested in the treatment plant, which was good for the city, and then built a pipeline to the mine.
I love that kind of idea. That's a great reuse of water, and it just seems like a terrific efficiency and a win-win for everybody.
Yeah, and reusing and recycling is sort of the mantra right now with the mining companies, is trying to minimize their water footprint, make better use of the water. If you have a limited water resource and you want to limit the volume of water that you have to treat and to discharge, it really just makes more sense to make the investment in processes that minimize water losses and try and recycle that as much as possible.
Right. So I think this question will build off kind of what one of your prior answers was, but what do you see as the biggest risks facing water-related risks facing the mining industry today?
Well, that's a real broad question, because water risk can be broken down into regulatory, reputational, financial, social, environmental, and operational risks. All of those are affected by water. And so, if you are discharging water without adequate treatment, you've got environmental, you've got social, you've got potential regulatory risk, if you are pulling a lot of water out of the aquifer and the local communities are going dry, you're going to have social risks. And a lot of people are, a lot of the resistance to mining operations is based on the perception, sometimes merited, that the mine is going to remove their water resources and discharge contaminated water. You know, that is something that used to happen. It's not nearly as common as it used to be. And it still happens, though, in poorly regulated countries or, the big part, these are all so closely associated. If you look at the Ernst & Young risk diagram that they put out every year, you know, almost every year, ESG associated with environmental, you know, that's associated with water and water use. License to operate has got a big social aspect. And more in the Ernst & Young reading, we're seeing an increased concern about climate change. And that is intimately tied to water resources.
Yeah, it sounds like mining companies are almost inherently in conflict, balancing the need to extract the mineral, use water in that process, dewater the mine, and, you know, impact sustainability and stewardship, and while doing all that, make a profit so that they can pay shareholders.
Right. And you know, you touched on two topics, stewardship and investors. And the investment community is very concerned about water, because while mining companies are willing to expend enormous amounts of money to define a resource, it's really hard to define as accurately the water resource and the social implications of water for a mining project. And I had a conversation with Rick Rule about 7 years ago, where he talked to me after I gave a presentation, and he said, this is something that we wrestle with. How do we quantify the risk associated with water and social to make better investment decisions? And, you know, the answer is you really have to invest more in those aspects of it. You have to invest more in the baseline characterization of the water resource and the impact that the mining operation will have on water stakeholders. And that goes back to stewardship. You can't think of water as a consumable. It's a shared resource. It's under stress. With social networking, people are better able to exchange information about, you know, incorrect or accurate about the impact, the potential impact of a mining operation on water resources and ecosystems and agriculture and, you know, all the other water users. Water resources have a very big stakeholder group. And so the concept of stewardship, of going in and saying, we are the temporary custodians of a shared resource and that we are going to protect, preserve, and possibly enhance it, and then return it to, as much as we can, an original state. And the companies that are embracing this are getting ahead of the companies that are still thinking of it as just a commodity.
Interesting point. When you say getting ahead, what do you mean?
Actually have corporate level philosophies and hard plans saying every mining operation that we own has got to have a water management plan, has got to have a water balance, has got to have a groundwater model. That water is considered from the earliest phases of the baseline characterization all the way through the closure planning, and that closure planning addressing water and other topics is continuously updated. The old mantra of mining to closure, which is becoming more and more of a reality. You can't put off your water issues until you get to closure. You have to plan them from the very beginning, all the way to closure. It's a continuous process.
Right. And when also, is there an element of in getting ahead? Is that it was an economic getting ahead in terms of if you enhance and preserve and polish up your reputation with, especially with regulators, it will make an easier time for the entity getting permits and working through.
No, absolutely. And this goes back to social license. You know, Marlin, which was owned by Goldcorp in Central America, they had a good social program. And what they would do, you know, there's always someone saying that the mine is lying, you know, that the water isn't representative of the actual discharge. And so what Marlin would do is they invited the community, they educated the community and invited the community to participate in the monitoring program. And so they would, the mine staff would go and take samples and the community would be there taking duplicates. And Marlin taught them how to do that. They paid the analyses. And so the community had their own water samples that they sent to a lab. They controlled that analytical process with guidance from Marlin to ensure that the data that Marlin was reporting was factual. That's a really brilliant little piece of social license, is to involve the communities as stakeholders in the process. Open communication and sharing data is a great way to quiet the naysayers, the people that are saying that, you're contaminating the local water resource. And it happens all the time. And it's not just, it's everywhere. I mean, it happens here in Colorado. The people that cherry pick the data or make up outright lies in Cuscatlan, there was a local priest who was subsidized by a Canadian anti-mining group who was saying the mine is going to collapse your houses. The mine is going to suck all the groundwater out. And the mine wasn't even planning to use ground. So, being open and sharing data and communicating with the communities is really an absolute key element of a social program.
Yeah, interesting. So, I'd like to switch gears a little bit. I mean, I love the track we've been on, but I also have heard anecdotally about mine tailings, and you mentioned that earlier. And I'd just like to explore that a little more. Why are tailings such a big issue?
Tailings are, okay, traditionally tailings were a water retention dam into which you pumped tailings, finely ground rock at say 50% water, and then it settled out, and then you had the water flows backward to the back of the tailings dam into a pool, and you pump it back to your operation. A lot of water gets lost into the tailing pores. A lot of it evaporates in certain climates. The problem is that you're basically dealing with a dam. And after some spectacularly and devastating dam failures in Brazil and the spectacular but not terribly environmentally impactful Mount Polley failure, people started to say, we need to get away from this. And, the SME and the ICMM have been leading, and Australian governments, really in the last 10 years, there's been a tremendous effort to get away from water dams. I know that Goldcorp would like to get entirely away from the whole concept of any kind of water structure that they don't need, because they fail. Not all of them, but if you have to maintain them for a long time, and if they're not operated right, they're a liability. And so the industry is doing a tremendous amount of research and moving as fast as it can towards minimizing the water content in tailings, either by using filter tailings, which are, you know, you suck as much of the water out. So basically what you're depositing is just a wet sand that you have to push around. It has to be deposited in trucks or conveyor belts. And you push it around and you can, and you compact it. And, you know, since it doesn't have that water content, you still should have a dam to contain it, but it doesn't have to be a water dam. It is just basically a berm. And there's, it's much more stable geotechnically. And so there, you know, there's some real advantages of it. So the industry is really moving this away from tailings dams because of the risk and the liability associated with them.
You know, that leads to a great segue to what I was next planning on asking you. And you've been in the industry for 2 decades now. And so what are you seeing as the biggest transformations in the mining industry related to water over the last 2 decades?
The tailings, as I just mentioned, better water use, better recycling, water treatment, better planning. And, you know, there's a number of very good best practice documents out there, such as the INAP guard guide, where they're really talking, you know, they're really focusing on saying you have to do the research up front. You have to plan for closure up front, which includes a lot of water issues, because when you start planning early, it's cheaper in the long run and you have more options. If you don't start thinking about closure and water management until the end of the project, it's more expensive and you have many, you know, your options are far fewer. And so, you know, again, a lot of the mining companies are starting to talk about stewardship. They're starting to implement company-wide policies to ensure that there's a stewardship across the board at their mining operations and make closure more viable and cheaper in the long run for them.
Can you talk a bit about, let's kind of bring this full circle, and you've got this environmental geochemistry degree. So what's the relationship between environmental geochemistry and water? How do you bring all that together related to mines?
Well, mines produce a tremendous amount of waste rock. You know, the commodity is actually a small percentage of the total mass. And a lot of that rock has metals, or in many of the deposits, particularly coppers, is associated with a hydrothermal deposit that has iron sulfides, pyrite, particular. And, you know, if those are not managed, characterized at the beginning and managed well, you have the possibility of that pyrite oxidizing and producing acid and then leaching more metals out of either the pyrite or the other minerals that are associated with it. So, and it's a water issue again. It's, you know, the water is what conveys the products of the pyrite oxidation into the environment. And this is something that, you know, wasn't really well, I'm not going to say it wasn't well understood, because it's been known for centuries, but it wasn't identified as an environmental issue until, you know, starting in the 70s and 80s. And then, you know, there's been a tremendous amount of work by the governments, by INAP, on this. And, you know, what causes this? How do you characterize? How do you manage the waste? Do you isolate it? Do you blend it? Do you amend it? Do you mix it with paste and put it back into a mine? Do you co-dispose of it with mixing waste, acidic waste rock with fine grain tailings, which limit the oxygen diffusion and movement of water? And so, you know, this whole strategy of, you know, we know what we're going to produce because we've characterized it from the very beginning, and we're going to start managing it from the very beginning so that we can minimize the long-term potential impact from that material.
Terrific. Well, Patrick, you've been absolutely great. I have learned so much about the mining industry and water in the mining industry today. It's been phenomenal speaking with you. Do you have a leave behind message that you'd like to leave the listeners with?
Yeah. Society as it is right now is going to continue to require mineral resources. So mining is going to continue to be an essential component of our modern society. And so the evolution towards green energy is not eliminating the need for mining. It's just shifting the focus on the commodities. We need more lithium. We need more copper. We still have a lot of requirements for all of the infrastructure to generate solar and wind and marine energy. And lithium and rare earths. So we all of those are going to continue to create challenges for water. So sustainable water management is a critical component of our mining future. And to do that, you need to do good baseline studies. You need to have solid waste rock characterization and management plans. And the mining companies need to focus more on characterizing the water resources and how they're going to manage it over long term. So you're interested in learning more, you can go to our website at intera.com, or you can contact me at my email at pwilliamson@intera.com.
Terrific. Well, Patrick, thank you so much again for a terrific talk. I really enjoyed this and much appreciated, and we'll be in touch soon.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the interest. And it's a lot of fun to talk about something that you do all day.
Yeah. You're obviously passionate about it, so I appreciate you sharing your insights. Thanks so much, Patrick. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you, Dave.
Awesome interview by Patrick. It really opened my eyes to not only mining. By the way, I loved his statement that if it can't be grown, it's got to be mined. But it also opened my eyes to the multitude of ways that water factors into and affects mining activities. I'd love to know what you thought about the interview. Please check out the show notes page for information and links on this episode. Just Google the Water Values Podcast. Click the first link that comes up. That's our landing page at the Bluefield Research website. Again, the Water Values LLC and Bluefield Research are not affiliates. We just have a joint marketing arrangement. And as part of that, Bluefield Research provides us a home on the web. You can email me at david.mcgimsey@dentons.com, and you can sign up for the newsletter at that aforementioned landing page as well. Well, thank you again for tuning in, and I hope you make it a great day. Plus, I want to give a huge thank you to our sponsors. Again, sponsors of the Water Values Podcast include Intera, Xylem, the American Water Works Association, Black & Veatch, 120 Water, Advanced Drainage Systems, 1898 & Co., and Woodard & Curran. This show would not be possible without those great companies and industry leaders. And again, thank you for listening and for subscribing to the Water Values Podcast. Your support is truly appreciated. In closing, please remember to keep the core message of the Water Values Podcast in mind as you go about your daily business. Water is our most valuable resource, so please join me by going out into the world and acting like it.
You've been listening to the Water Values Podcast. Thank you for spending some of your day with my dad and me.
Well, thank you for tuning in to the disclaimer. I'm a lawyer licensed in Indiana and Colorado, and nothing in this podcast should be taken as providing legal advice or as establishing an attorney-client relationship with you or with anyone else. Additionally, nothing in this podcast should be considered a solicitation for professional employment. I'm just a lawyer that finds water issues interesting and that believes greater public education is needed about water issues. And that includes enhancing my own education about water issues, because no one knows everything about water.